Hello and welcome to the Super Show podcast, your home for video game news every single week. This time, Jamie, coming at you only 4 days after the last podcast because we had a little bit of a screw up because I was not about. But thank you for joining me today, Jamie. And thank you everyone else for joining us to talk about some video game news. How the hell are you doing?
I'm doing all right, but it was a stretch to get here because we struggled to find, you know, a 90-minute, two-hour-long podcast on even the best of weeks. So to do it on a four-day week where, like, the most interesting things to talk about are Will Smith being in a video game that no one knows exists, like, we're scrounging a little bit, but I like it. Do you know what, Jonesy? When you introduce these podcasts in that upbeat, joie de vivre way that you do, that's what really gets me going. So that's what makes me happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to hear that because, yeah, the news isn't going to be the most exciting this week because we've only had a few days to pull from. But actually, we've got some pretty decent stories. We're going to be talking about Dragon's Dogma 2, some quote-unquote controversies surrounding the release of that. Also, Will Smith, his game unfortunately bombing, as you were saying, Jamie. And we're also going to get onto a bit of GTA 6 news with Rockstar reportedly falling behind in the production of their game. But first up, I want to give a shout out to some absolutely awesome, amazing people who are in the chat right now watching us live on YouTube. And I'm going to, you know what I'm going to say? I have to say his name first because he said first in the chat is Pastor's Guild. Also, Magni, Damir Kalagjiran. That's really hard to say. And Nick Leakes in the chat.
That's someone out of June too.
I've not seen it yet. Oh, Randall Flagg is popping up.
Listen, our guy Eve in the chat. Shout out.
I need to see June 2. I've not seen it yet. So, yeah.
Yeah, you probably should.
Oh, okay. And someone else as well. We've got Zidane Maulana saying, that's a hot take. Dragon's Dogma is woke. I've not played it, so I don't know.
Well, actually, do you know what? If we were going to go on the current social media definition of the word woke, which is to say no definition whatsoever, then I actually think it is woke. In the same way that this podcast is a little bit woke, I think your glasses are striking me as a bit too woke right now as well, though. So just keep an eye on them. That's what I'm saying.
I'll keep an eye on them indeed. But I would also like to give a little nod to our Twitter, X. Now, I always do that, our X. Yeah. If you want to go over there, you can reach out to us at Super Show Pod. We are on YouTube as well at Super Show Pod. We're also available across major podcasting platforms, talking Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts. So you can listen to us in audio without having to see our little faces. But if you want to see our faces, you can do that too. We are also on paisleyradio.com on Thursdays at 10 p.m, repeated on Mondays at 10 p.m, where you can listen to us as though it were yesteryear. And we will come at you as pseudo live, but we won't really be live. It will be recorded. And with that, Jamie, let's get into our first story.
Let's do it.
So this is the story that Will Smith was the face of a zombie game which was made last year, released last year in June of 2023. But you would be forgiven for never having heard of Undawn, because I hadn't heard of it. Had you heard of it, Jamie?
Absolutely not. I hadn't heard of it, hadn't heard the name, and even when pieces of key art starring one of the most successful actors of our time appeared on the internet, I was none the wiser.
But it was on mobile and PC, and it was from a Chinese conglomerate Tencent. And as we said, it had Will Smith in it, and he was a major role in the story. So you'd think this had all the elements that you would require in order for a game to do pretty well. It's got Will Smith, especially after the slap. I would have thought more people would want to play a Will Smith game post-slap.
Yeah, maybe that was their problem. Maybe they didn't work the slap into the game enough. Maybe the game was about slapping zombies to death, that actually they could have got some traction. I don't know, just thinking.
That would, imagine if they had, if he'd have just yelled at them, "Get my wife's name out your mouth," and then slapped around the face.
Yeah, he said with a zombie twist, like, "Keep my fucking brains out of your fucking mouth."
Yes.
And then just slapping them.
And then this slaps their jaw off.
I love it. Perfect.
That would have been pretty cool. But March 21st, Reuters report, actually said that the game has flopped spectacularly, which will not be that surprising to anyone listening to this because you've not heard of it. So you'd probably be forgiven, for not having heard of it, and then also be correct in thinking it flopped because no one played the thing. No one knew it was about. It was a post-apocalyptic zombie shooter, as you will not be surprised to hear. It had more than 300 developers working on it, and it had a budget, I'm going to say this in yuan just because it's bigger, had a budget of nearly 1 billion yuan.
You just wanted to have your Dr. Evil moment.
$140 million. So a decent budget. It wasn't a cheap game to produce.
Far from it, yeah.
Which then sort of begs the question, Jamie, what happened? What the hell happened?
I feel like if I was able or qualified to answer that question, I'd be working for one of the mobile companies making games like this and doing postmortems on it. I don't really know. Look, there's a part of me that thinks that this is kind of a bit of a, not necessarily a shock, but there's a little bit of a surprise to it. But that I think you can also dig a little bit beneath the surface and go, actually, maybe I'm not all that surprised that it passed me by. I think the thing that catches your attention is that open world zombie survival shooter games, in theory, are relatively accessible in terms of the, you know, the audience's relationship with that genre. Like, you know, it seems like the kind of thing that could, you know, penetrate the mainstream to a certain extent. Tencent are a major company, and yes, while they are Chinese and a lot of their audience are based in the East, you don't go out and pursue a star like Will Smith and get him uploading, for example, the reveal trailer to the game to his personal YouTube channel, unless you're trying to do a little bit of something to gain some kind of traction in the West. And then, of course, you have the budget. You know, a $140 million game, in spite of some of the other numbers we're probably going to discuss over the course of this conversation, I think it's important to remember that $140 million is still a massive budget for a video game, let alone one that's targeting, I'm presuming, mobile first, PC second. 300 developers, again, a lot of people. All those things kind of make it seem like a miracle that, like, so many people could have simply not have heard of this. But at the same time, there is an element where, and I think this is especially true in the mobile market, perhaps slightly less so in the PC market when you're talking about the scale, but especially in the mobile market, like $100 million, or let's just say nine-figure video games are being developed for predominantly Eastern audiences on mobile devices that I will never have heard of every single day. And I remember, maybe not every single day, I don't know, there's that much money or case being thrown around, but I remember when we were at ATG, and one of the things that was always really fascinating was obviously we made a lot of list videos, and there are so many easy pieces of low-hanging fruit to go for, whether it's most expensive games, and of course one of them was always most popular games. And people sort of sit there and think, well, you know, maybe Fortnite and Roblox, and then back in the day you'd even get conversations about how Call of Duty might factor into the conversation.
Definitely, yeah.
And you're like, no, this Chinese game that you've never heard of that is essentially a rip-off of Counter-Strike, as an example, is the biggest game on the planet. And it's because you can't wrap your head around how many people in whether it's in countries like China and South Korea, and the similar phenomenons have also occurred in South America, right, as well, especially when you're talking about mobile devices. Like, sometimes the sizes of these audiences are just unfathomable. So I don't know if this is just me, what I'm saying is I've kind of gotten used to the idea that massive games can exist that I haven't heard of. I suppose where Undawn tips the scales in an unusual direction is when it makes $287,000 in revenue, and that's it.
I think that's the surprising thing. I think, as you've said, there's a lot of games like this out there, and especially with a celeb backing, you'd think that they were going to do well, it was going to propel them in that market, and there's going to be a bit of a money spinner. But no, I think the surprising thing about this is how little it made. So yeah, I'll repeat that value just because it's kind of crazy. So $130 million production, $287,000 in revenue, which is like barely anything.
It's like 0.2% or something.
But it always makes me think of whenever you see very famous actors be in adverts in places like China, Japan, like India, things like that, and they'll spend a fortune getting actors over to be in adverts. I imagine this is kind of the same deal. Will Smith was paid a buttload of money. He's probably paid a decent chunk of the $130 million development cost to be in the game, to read his lines, and to post it on his own personal social to give it that boost.
But then again, like when you bring in Will Smith and it's on a platform like YouTube, which, as far as I know, you know, users in China can't even access.
No, they have their own version, don't they?
Right, I think they have their own versions of a few different like video sites and social media sites. Right, there's all kinds of stuff. I'm not an expert in it. And he's speaking in English. It's an English language. Like you're very much trying to draw in like in that sense anyway, a Western audience. So as much as we all think of like Bill Murray doing Santoro whiskey in Lost in Translation, it didn't really seem to be that.
No, that's true. But then at the same time, I think I like Will Smith. I think you give him a lot of credit thinking he could have done it in Chinese, in Mandarin. Or that would have been interesting if he did.
You need to hire John Cena for that these days.
You do. You absolutely do. Just as a bit of a comparison, honestly, before I say that, let's say so the Undawn reached a peak of 8,531 players 9 months ago, which is according to Steam Tracker, SteamDB. But just as a bit of a comparison, right? So just to give you a sort of a crazy numbers comparison. This also comes just one, the report from Reuters comes just 1 week after we found out that Monopoly Go's marketing spend was revealed to be $500 million, which is like just to, the numbers that you deal with in gaming, marketing, mobile. Some of these figures are absolutely astronomical.
Yes.
Like that is crazy.
Again, outrageous numbers. And it makes sense, right? Like, again, one thing that I kind of, you have to truly check yourself before you reg yourself on is that people like Phil Spencer, who, you know, is obviously fighting the Xbox fight over there, loves to go on interviews and talk about the number of gamers there are and the number of people who you can consider a gamer on like, you know, just for the sake of the statistic and how that number is now in the billions. It's like, make no mistake about it, like the number of gamers is in the billions solely because of mobile phones. You can go back to, you know, console generations, home console generations through the 90s into the early 2000s, all the way up to now. And you can, at the peak, add up the number of PS3, Xbox 360 and Wii's out there, or add up the number of PS4, Xbox Ones and Switches out there. That market hasn't actually grown substantially, like, ever. There's never really more than, what, like, maximum 300 to 400 million home consoles out there at any one time. Like,
that's weird to think about that.
Yeah, it's just, it's never changed. And yet somehow we're sitting here going, invest in Xbox because there are like over a billion gamers out there. It's like, well, the reason there are a billion gamers out there is because smartphone tech has gotten to the point where even in less economically developed areas markets like South America, where the demand for video games is huge, but traditionally the home console market has been a little step behind. You know, I always remember Brazil was the always given as the reason why FIFA or EA Sports, I guess rather, would continue to develop FIFA on the PlayStation 2 for years after the PlayStation 2 had almost ceased production in other parts of the world because it was still one of the most popular and owned consoles in Brazil. Massive market for gamers. People are now getting smartphones and they have the potential to play games, you know, in their pocket. There's a convenience factor, all the other things that we associate with mobile gaming, but in markets where home console gaming just isn't really that relevant or there's reasons why it's less popular than mobile gaming. And that's what creates these numbers.
Can I force a controversial take from you? Attempt to?
Yeah. Okay.
If someone, this hypothetical person, is solely a mobile gamer and has only ever been a mobile gamer.
Yeah.
And let's put away things like PlayStation Remote, stuff like that. So they're just playing mobile-only games. Are they a gamer?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, they are.
Okay.
I don't know, because, like...
Only solitaire on their mobile phone?
I still think they are, like, maybe that's because I don't actually like the word gamer that much, and so there's no part of me that wants to say to like gatekeep the word gamer, because I don't call myself a gamer. It just feels like a weirdly, like, almost a corny word to use, you know? Like, do you describe yourself? I mean, obviously you describe yourself as a gamer, but do you identify with that word?
No. If someone says to me, "Are you a gamer?" my brain says my brain hears that as they want to know if I play games, and so it's easier just to say yes. But if I was speaking to someone else who played video games, they're not going to say to me, "Are you a gamer?" They're going to be like, they're going to go, "What are you playing?"
Exactly. Or being asked if you're a gamer is a telltale sign that you're talking to someone who doesn't play games.
Yes. Yes. But this is going to sound mean now. There is a subset of people, let's call them, like, mums.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know exactly where this is going.
Who only play, like, solitaire and Candy Crush on their phones. Yeah. And if someone said to me, oh, you like games, don't you? And I said, yeah, I do. And they said, oh, yeah, my mum likes games too. You've probably got a lot in common. I'd be like, we both like games, but I don't think that's the same. It's like someone saying, oh, my friend plays tennis, and someone going, oh, my friend plays darts. They'll get on really well. And you're like, yeah, they're similar, but they're not the same kind of thing. I'm not calling out mobile phone gamers. I just find it. I don't know why we need to gatekeep.
Like,
No, we don't.
If I had a friend who never went to the cinema and watched one new movie a year, and I said to them, "Do you like movies?" And they said, "Well, yeah, I do." And I said, "Oh, you'd be best friends with this cinephile I know who goes to the weekend three times a week." Like, we don't like get. Just because there are different spectrum, there's a massive spectrum that games can exist on, doesn't mean we need to be picky about. And like, yes, they all mean different things. And like, my mum somewhere in her house has a Nintendo DS Lite and a copy of Brain Training that got used like three times
because someone thought it would
make it. Yeah, exactly. Like, now my mum is therefore a lapsed gamer, but for as weird as it was to say, like, to think about, for a period of time, she probably was, by definition, and for the sake of, you know, statistical kind of like easiness, simplicity, she probably was a gamer. Yeah.
So the reason I asked the question is not to gatekeep, is to then say, do you think when reports come out and we talk about numbers of gamers, etc., do we do ourselves and the audience and the industry a misservice by not being more specific when we try and talk about specific categories? Because actually, maybe we shouldn't claim. Do you know what? There are 2 billion gamers out there, and gaming is a bigger industry than movies, television, and music combined. Maybe we should say mobile is the biggest thing out there, and they can claim that. But actually, we as console gamers, PC gamers, whatever, maybe we shouldn't.
I think you're onto something there when it comes to there are more ways of clarifying exactly what we mean when we flout certain statistics. But I think there's a reason that people like you and me, or actually, I don't want to speak for you, people like me. Don't do that. And it's because sometimes when I do bring up facts like the video game industry generating more revenue than the film industry and the music industry combined, it's because I'm almost doing that to justify a hobby that some part of my brain still feels like needs justification. Because I'm talking to people who think that a lot of these things are true, that I'm some weird like basement dwelling, doesn't get enough sunlight, you know, vitamin D deprived weirdo who's, you know, spends all this time, three times playing video games. And some part of me wants to go like, look how many people are doing this. Look at how legitimate it is. Get off my back. And yeah,
right.
I guess I would have to concede that in doing so, I do borrow from, or I do broaden or make like certain statements generic enough that they end up including people who are very unlike me. But that doesn't mean those people can't be any less committed. And you talk about mobile gamers, you even talk about a game like Candy Crush. If you met someone who played Candy Crush 12 hours a day and spent $1,000 a month on it, you'd be like, oh my God, they're in a weird sense, a more hardcore gamer than me.
Yes.
Like, they just don't play the kind of games I associate with hardcore gaming. But I think those goalposts are moving.
I think people must think that about me when I talk about, like, I'll play 20 hours of like any game, but realistically, like when someone says to me, oh, I've played 500 hours of Persona 5 Royal or whatever, and I'm like, yeah, I played 2 hours of that game and got bored. And then and they're like, oh, how many games have you played this year? I'm like, I've played 15 games this year, and my total time spent in game is less than they've spent in one game. And I can and sometimes you just get that look, and you're like, they just think I'm a filthy casual, and they're like, you're not a real gamer. I'm like, but hey, different strokes for different folks. We all game individually in our own way. If I'm going to be completely honest, I used to think a little bit differently about those people, and I know many of them, and this is the only reason I was a little bit bitter about it. Loads of my friends used to only play COD and FIFA, and whenever we would talk video games, they couldn't talk about anything. I'm talking for years, like 10 years of my life, they could only talk about COD and FIFA, and I would be like, we're not really the same, are we? Because I'm playing millions of other things, and I want to talk about this and this and this, and all you know is COD and FIFA. I don't necessarily think we're the same. We're not in the same sort of category of person who plays video games.
Yeah, I in a weird sense. But I think like one thing that happens, especially when you go out on the internet and you talk about these things like we do, is you get to notice that actually that's because we have just gone deeper and deeper into what is increasingly becoming, and will only like become more so a niche part of a massive, massive market. And like, you go back to the film comparisons that we've made a couple of times in this conversation, like we are the guys trying to initiate conversations about French New Wave, like, and everyone else is looking at us like we're weirdos. And the reality is, like, yeah, for as long as there are, you know, quote-unquote billions of gamers and the most popular mobile games on the planet, you know, let's say draw in 500 million players, then all of a sudden us saying, oh yeah, my favorite, you know, like me talking about Balatro, which would be considered a massive success story because it's just crossed 1 million sales. It's like, you have to recognize them when you're kind of approaching a niche. And that was always true to a certain extent of like people who played indie games like Balatro, but is, I think, over time going to become more and more the case for things like the console market. And that's why we're in a situation where even like the status of the big three console manufacturers are shaky, and people are constantly looking at console manufacturers like Xbox and being like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Like, when are you going to crash it out? Because, yeah, it's like the industry is going through very strange times, and we are, even though the number of home console gamers remains consistent, as other areas of the industry grows, we as a proportion of the wider industry continue to shrink. And which is why we have all, it's the reason I go home at Christmas and I see a relative who I haven't seen for 10 years and they look at me, they hear I work in the games industry and they presume I earn six figures. And I go, it ain't like that. Like, I know you hear about the game industry and how big it is, and it is that big, and there is that much money in it.
I don't work for
someone will spend exactly. I don't work for the companies that spend $500 million advertising a Monopoly game that goes on to generate $2 billion.
Like, yes.
The industry, yes, you know, so, yeah.
Let's round off this one then. Before we do, just to give you a little bit of a sense of scale, as Jamie just said, so like Monopoly Go's marketing spend was 500 million. It made 2 billion. Just to kind of give you an idea as to where that fits in the wider sort of console market and gaming market in general, you know, the more of our side. So Last of Us Part 2, development budget for that was 220 million. And Horizon Forbidden West, development budget was around 212 million. So the marketing spend alone for Monopoly Go was over twice the development budgets for both of those games, was more than both of those games' development budgets combined.
Yes. You know, and those were already being touted as two of the most bloated and unsustainable development budgets in the industry. Like, I think, was it today that Remedy announced their initial budget for the multiplayer project they've got going on over there? Condor was, I think, $25 million,
which is much more to my brain goes like 200 million for development, and I'm like, that is all I can think is that is just thousands of artists just making loads of elements for these massive sprawling games, and I'm like, yeah, that's why they're so big and so expensive. But and I love that, I love how big these games are, I love how gorgeous they are, I love the amount of, but then at the same time you're like, that is, they're spending so much money to make these. And they've got to be able to bring those budgets down. Otherwise, it's just not sustainable, like, unfortunately, you know.
But true. Some mess got to give.
Before we move on and we give a little shout out to some absolutely amazing people, I want to give a shout out to one individual person, Randall Flagg, putting up the £5 super chat in the chat on YouTube, who says, thanks for all the awesome shows, guys. You guys are legends. Getting this in now because you're accompanying me on my drive up the M20 soon. We'll drive safely. Don't speed. Don't. What are the other things you can't do? Stay 2 seconds behind the. Oh, well, have a safe journey. Enjoy.
Don't drink. Don't do drugs.
Don't be tired. What were those things?
Is this a grey area or like a black and white area? Getting head while you're driving.
No, I think that's fine, but don't finish.
Okay.
Because if you
there you go.
Yeah, because if you finish it. And then you might pull a face and look out.
There isn't going to be like an asterisk in whatever the UK law book that says you can get head but you can't nut.
Right. Randall Flagg, specify. I'm telling you now, you can roadhead's fine, don't nut. You'll be okay. But then if you get pulled over for it, then we didn't say that because we don't.
Technically, again, you can go through that whole process including nutting and keep your hands at 10 and 2.
I saw a video. I accidentally happened upon a video the other day.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, was it a misclick, Mr. Jones?
It was a misclick, and it was a clip of a guy. It wasn't just the head. It was the whole thing. Like, she was on his lap in the driving seat, and I immediately was thinking, like, is this a self-drive situation, or is this a you know, the thing they do in Hollywood films where they don't use CGE, they like put the car on the back of a trailer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was like, is it one of these? Because how is no one spotting that and being like, how are they not getting in trouble for that? You'd think at this day and age with cameras everywhere. But I get the impression it was like from one of those weird series, you know, like not Fake Taxi, that kind of thing, that sort of it thing, right?
Right, the new pretender to the Fake Taxi throne, which is like, people having sex in the driver's seat of self-driving cars, maybe.
Are you allowed to do that? I don't know if you're allowed to
do that.
I don't
know. Well, no, because then we get into weird conversations about, like, I presume that, like, what you're doing in a car, especially in a car that just has, like, regular untinted windows, is technically considered something you're doing in public. And so are you then getting into indecency kind of crimes, even if...
Okay, because maybe.
I don't know. Like, because you can't have sex in public legally. And I don't know.
Why not?
I don't know if a car door is enough to protect you. I've got a joke about a car door.
Oh, let's hear it.
An Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman get stuck in a desert, and a genie appears and says, "I'll grant you all one wish." It's three wishes, but you're only going to get one each. And the Englishman asks for a load of water, and the Scotsman asks for a load of food, and the Irishman asks for a car door. And when the genie disappears, the Englishman and the Scotsman ask the Irishman, "Why the hell would you ask for a car door in the middle of the scorching Sahara Desert?" He said, "So I can wind the window down when it gets a bit hot."
There you go.
Wait, actually, hang on. Don't say anything. Thoughts? Out of 10, maybe?
That is not your best. I'm gonna have to say, it's one of them.
That's the end of the sound effect. That's the end of the sound effect tower, folks. I'm sorry.
Anyway, let's move on. Let's give a shout out to some absolute legends of the gaming world. We're not gatekeeping any of these people. They are our patrons who've supported us by going over to patreon.com/. The Super Show, and the fact that they've supported us means that we can keep this little train on the tracks for at least another week. We can keep chugging along. And a lot of you have been around for what's that?
I was going to say, at least another week. You're really setting the bar high, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, hey, you never know. You never know what's going to happen week to week. But no, some of you have been with us for a very long time now, and really does still surprise us, and we're very grateful. But I would like to give a shout out to some of you. There are some names on screen right now, as you will see, but I would also like to give a personal shout out to Aaron Cameron, Athletic Gravy, Brimstone, Ice Nog Rock Salt, Jesper Camden Nielsen, Pastors Guild, and the big dogs, the members of the board. It's Brett Z, aka Shellshock, Geometric Potter, Hacksawbuck Reed, Manuel Guerrero, and Peaswad. Thank you all so much. As I've said, and we'll continue to say week after week, because it's still one of the craziest things about this little podcast that we've got going on is people actually support us, and not to mention the people in chat and the people who like and everyone who does all that stuff, the comments underneath the videos, the 5-star ratings across podcast platforms. It is pretty amazing, so thank you so much.
Yeah, it's the reason this thing's still a thing.
Absolutely. But I would like to hear, Jamie, the reason that you still come back to gaming is to play games, and so I want to hear about what games you've played in the last week, or things you've done, stuff you've watched, anything else you want to talk about.
Do you know what? I don't think I've watched anything of note, but I have fortunately been able to course correct after a few weeks of slacking in the gameplay department by jumping off one of last week's new releases. I think I'd mentioned in previous podcasts that I'd kind of narrowed it down to either Dragonstalker 2 or Rise of the Ronin, and I was waiting to see what the reviews were like, and also to see what the pressure from the Discord was like. And in the end, I caved, and I have now played a solid amount of Dragon's Dogma 2. Not a ridiculous amount. I know that there are diehard Dragon's Dogma fans out there that have probably already damn near completed this fucker. I'm not one of those, but I've played enough that I feel like I can come on a podcast and talk about it. How about that?
That is plenty for me, and I'm looking forward to this, because I've I have been very impressed by what I've seen of Dragon's Dogma, but I could do with some insider info. So yeah, let's spill the tea, as the kids say.
I guess that, you know, I was impressed by what I saw as well, and I think that was one of the first things that I kind of found intriguing, is that, you know, there are so many games and series and genres out there that are kind of well-worn territory for us by now, that we can kind of look at a certain game, let's say Rise of the Ronin, for example, and we can kind of break it down to its constituent parts, and we can kind of be like, well, there's a bit of a sort of a slightly lackluster, maybe Assassin's Creed inspired open world, but then you've got kind of like that Team Ninja style combat that I know, like, for me, I didn't usually feel drawn to in Neo or Final Fantasy Origin or anything like that. And so maybe Rise of the Ronin will be a bit of a miss for me had I actually gone in that direction. I don't know about you, Jonesy, but I was watching Dragon's Dogma 2 footage and I was enjoying a lot of what I was seeing. I think it's quite an inherently pretty game. I think their utilization of some kind of like I think it's like ray trace driven sort of like global illumination and stuff like that. A lot of the lighting looks really nice and natural. And a lot of the fundamentals of the game look quite strong. But there was also something I couldn't quite put my finger on, which is like, what's the moment? What's it feel like to play Dragon's Dogma 2? Like, what is kind of like the moment to moment? And so that was the part of that kind of fascinated me. And I think that's why I kind of took the plunge in the end. And I've got to say, it is a fascinating game that is... It's not hard to talk about. There's a lot to talk about it, but it's hard to talk about it in a certain sense because there aren't many convenient analogs for what Dragon's Dogma 2 is like. Like, again, you'd be tempted to look at it and say, well, maybe there are definitely inspirations from Software titles and maybe a bit of Elden Ring in there. Like, you'd maybe say that there's a bit of Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom in kind of its natural approach to exploration and emergent gameplay. You'd maybe say that there's maybe some Death Stranding in there with its kind of its focus on it being about more of the journey than the destination and some of the interesting online systems. But it's really none of these games. what it is that it's this very strange game that when you consider, and again, I never played the first Dragon's Dogma or Dark Arisen, so from what I understand, a lot of things that are true to Dragon's Dogma 2 are true of its predecessors, a predecessor and a half. So if I'm saying things that apply to both games as though it's something new, it's just because it's new to me. But like the idea that an Eastern development team, one of Capcom's internal teams, like wanted to approach more of a traditional Western fantasy RPG and like what they'd seen in, you know, the Elder Scrolls and I don't know, any other source of inspiration they had, like Lord of the Rings, whatever the fuck it was, and we're like, we want to make something like that. It's that's kind of a fascinating pitch, and it results in something that is mechanically very sound and surprisingly competent. Like there are times where I think you're looking at this game, and sometimes even when you're playing this game, where you'd be tempted to call it janky. And yet it somehow always sort of skirts that line and veers away from being janky in a sense. And I know competent can sound like a condescending word to use to describe a video game that was made by extremely talented people. But you know what I mean? Where you're like, there's a lot going on and it's mechanically dense and its world is dense. And it's, but like, it doesn't feel like it's falling apart. It feels like it's doing some very sophisticated things and yet actually has a solid grasp on them. But for me, it's really, so far, in terms of where it's been successful, it's been a success from more of a systems standpoint, and some of the systems are kind of fascinating. Like, you know, we played a lot of RPGs lately. You know, we talked last week about, you know, Disco Elysium and Baldur's Gate 3. Like, a lot of people have been drawn to and understandably so, very narrative driven RPGs in recent years. I don't think there's a lot of that going on in Dragon's Dogma.
Okay.
I think some of the writing and the performances are fine. In other parts of the game, they're little more than perfunctory, but really, like, there's nothing about any of the quests, main or side quests, that I've discovered that are really the draw. It's just they always act as an excuses to continue to leave the safety of a camp or a slightly more developed area of the map and go adventuring. And the reason it's to, like, you want to go adventuring are because of those systems that I was mentioning, and the promise of like what's going to happen for you between getting from A to B. And I think we talked about Helldivers 2 when that came out, and like how they had very intentionally shied away from what might have been considered quality of life features in to create a more memorable or just a more dynamic or more engaging game experience. Things like, hey, if you reload a magazine and there are still bullets left in that magazine, you've lost those bullets. Friendly fire isn't a toggle. Friendly fire is like a pillar of the Helldiver 3 experience, right? Dragon's Dogma 2 makes a lot of, not similar choices, but a lot of choices in the sense that they also eschew the traditional values that like quality of life would suggest. And so what you end up like dealing with is this like weirdly, it seems sounds like an odd word to use, but sometimes like weirdly oppressive game where like everything is kind of brutal, where, and forget some of the stuff we're going to talk about later, but like I'm trying to think of some examples. So like when you go out adventuring, you have, you know, a certain amount of health, but the more damage you take also restricts how much health you can replenish. So
I hate that.
So you might get to a point where you're down to the, like, you'd be able to use up to half of your health bar, which severely limits your ability to, you know, go out adventuring with confidence and taking on enemies. So the way you get around that is you have to rest, but you can't rest anywhere. You have to rest at certain campfires. And resting at campfires is a risk, because if there are enemies nearby, they can attack you and they will destroy the camp that you have unpacked to build this campfire and to rest. And if you lose it, you have to buy or find another one. And also carrying this campfire is extremely taxing, because a sort of a standard early game character build, the camp takes up about a quarter of your encumbrance for either for you or your primary pawn. Yeah, and also encumbrance isn't a binary thing like an Elder Scrolls or a Bethesda RPG where you're either over encumbered or you're not. How much you're carrying, it goes up from like light to average to heavy, and that affects how fast you run and how much how quickly you replenish stamina. And so you get into this weird system where like some of them are almost borderline survival like mechanics, and it doesn't get into like, there's no weapon degradation and there's no hunger meter and stuff like that. It doesn't get quite, but in the same way, like everyone played Breath of the Wild for the first time and was like, oh wait, Link can get cold in this game. Like there are elements like that that almost increase, if it's not the oppressiveness of the game, it's the amount of friction in the game. And I think what it does is it then ends up tapping into what a lot of games have tapped into, which is this idea, like, what happens when you put the player in an uncomfortable situation that they can't cheese their way out of? And From Software games have been doing that for a long time with their inherent difficulty and the strategy that has to be applied to combat. Helldivers, as we just mentioned, did that. Like, when, you know, that your time limit is up and you can't call in any stratagems and, you know, you have to think on your feet. Baldur's Gate and Disco Elysium, when you fail the skill check in the middle of a conversation and you're like, I need to think of another, I can't, like, I could save scum, but I'm not going to save scum. The game is asking me to think about another way of approaching this. The game is asking me to deal with this friction, to deal with this oppressiveness, because of the promise that memorable or meaningful moments will emerge from you pushing past that friction. And in creating these do or die or these fight or flight moments, you're going to have to engage with these systems that might seem unfair or might seem overdramatic or might seem like there's no quality of life to them in the traditional modern gaming sense. But actually, like, that's where the joy comes from. And it is like when you are on your last legs, when your characters all have half their health bar left, when you accidentally picked up everything along your journey, so you've got a very heavy carry load, so you barely have any stamina back, and just when you're about to get to a campfire and it's just about to turn to night, which is when even worse enemies come out, all of a sudden a dynamic event happens, like a giant griffin lands in front of you, and all of a sudden you're in a boss fight. Like, it's not like Elden Ring where you walk through a From Software game where you walk through a misty door for a fight you knew was on the other side. A griffin landed on your head and you don't know what, and like now you're fighting it, and then you get into the systems that are there to actually alleviate some of the stress, like the pawn system or like the fact that you can climb all over enemies like Shadow of the Colossus style and get to their weak points and stab the fucking shit out of them. And I've already had a moment where I was climbing on top of a griffin, stabbing the shit out of its face, and it decided to fly away. And this griffin took off into midair, and I spent about 30 seconds riding on a griffin's back as it flew over to the other side of the map and landed in its nest. And I continued to fight it in its nest and was just about to kill it when another griffin came and landed on top of us, and then I died. And it's like, everyone who's going to play Baldur's Gate 3 is going to have these moments, much like people had moments in Baldur's Gate 3 and Elden Ring.
Where Dragon's, like, Dogma, Dragon's Dogma 2. So I think you said Baldur's Gate 3 twice.
Sorry, my bad. Dragon's Dogma 2. Like, and in this era where everyone can share clips so easily on social media, everyone's going to have their, you know, Cyclops or Ogre, like, falling over and grabbing the other end of the ledge to make a bridge. Like, everyone's going to have that moment and go, like, wow, that didn't happen to anyone else. That was all these systems and all these design choices and everything that, like, that has been put into this game coalescing to create a moment that felt unique to me. And I had to take the plunge and go on this adventure and put myself out of my comfort zone to find those moments. And that's where it becomes rewarding. And I think that's where the real success of Dragon's Dogma lies. Yes, there's stuff around the edges for all the people who want something a little bit more traditional. There is, but then even those stuff kind of, like, are slightly weird. Like, yes, there are loads of quests, but quest givers aren't pointed out for you. You need to take notice in a town of someone who looks like they might need help or someone who looks like they might have something to say.
Okay.
You take on a quest that has a sense of urgency to it, or sounds like it has a sense of urgency to it. It probably does. If you sit on a side quest, if someone goes, can you go and save my wife? And you say, yeah, I'll go and save your wife, like you do in any other RPG, and you do it 50 hours later, their wife's probably dead by the time you get there.
See, I like that. I always find it really annoying in games where they'll say, oh, you've got to do this and we've got to do it quick, and then you've actually got forever. Like, there's nothing that happens until you, that's never made any sense to me. So it's nice to hear they've done that.
Dragon's Dogma 2 is that game. Like, it's the, like, as has already been talked about a lot and you might have heard about, there is fast travel in the game, but it's heavily deterred because, one, if you do it through ox carts, it's expensive and not always that convenient in terms of where you can get from and to, and there are other ways of doing it, but they use consumables that you don't actually have that much of. So 99% of the time, you're not fast traveling in this game.
Right.
You're looking at something that's a million, and that's where, like,
you're riding a griffin to the other side of them.
Well, in some cases you are. It's really hard to think of, like I said, clean analogs for it. In so many respects, it's unlike a lot of other games I've played, but I'm kind of digging it for that reason.
One of the things I felt when I was watching reviews and listening to people talk about it and reading reviews for it, it seemed like it was very, very heavy on RPG elements, but maybe too much so, in that you're going to spend so much time getting to grips with systems that it's going to sort of detract from the minute-to-minute enjoyment of the game. Is that fair, or do you think that that's actually not something you feel when you're playing it?
There are a lot of RPG systems, and there are a lot of tooltips that the first time they pop up, you'll read something and go, what the fuck is this game on about? But I do think they kind of, like, they drift into the background just a little bit. Like, and I think, like, coming to Dragon's Dogma 2 with a solid baseline understanding of how a lot of these kind of RPGs function will get you through a lot of it. And yes, like, there is that, like, coming to understand the, like, what vocations are, which are, like, this game's version of classes, I guess.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can swap vocations and that you can level up vocations to take augments.
You can hybridize them as well, right?
Yeah, there are a couple of vocations that are like a kind of a mixture of two other vocations, and there are certain things in my inventory right now that I'm reading the item description. I'm like, I'm not 100% sure that what that would do if I used it, so I'm just going to put it in storage. Like, right. So don't get me wrong, there are a lot of things, but for me, those are the kind of the more, this is a Capcom making an RPG style. Like, those aren't the systemic kind of decisions that interest me. For me, it's the more dynamic systemic decisions that as they pertain to the open world and the kind of things that can happen to you that are where this game is engaging. I think if it didn't have any of that, if it was far more linear and it had a fast travel system and it told you where quest givers are and side quests last forever and it gave people more runway to play it like they might play a Ubisoft action, open world action adventure RPG, where they're fast traveling around a lot, all of a sudden you start to critique the game in more terms.
I mean, Starfield was a game that fast travel was ubiquitous, and I don't think it was good because of it. I think when we talked about before Ghost of Tsushima, the fast travel in that on PlayStation 5 just got ridiculous because it was so, you could effectively, like, blip your way across a map in a direction because the fast travel was so quick. And it was sometimes fast travel and things like that can detract from your enjoyment. It can't, rather than getting to experience the world. So I'm not necessarily anti the idea of like, no, you don't get to fast travel everywhere all the time.
It's funny you mentioned Starfield as well, because in some respects, Starfield is like is the antithesis of Dragon's Dogma 2.
Right.
In that when we were having a conversation about Starfield and the things we would have praised, like we praised quest lines on, and we praised the writing behind certain characters and certain reveals and payoffs and maybe some gameplay moments in a traditional sense. Whereas Dragon's Dogma 2 is almost the opposite. You will forge relationships in Dragon's Dogma 2, but a lot of them will be to generic pawns that someone created, and they probably look like a monstrosity. My pawn is called Ham Hock, and he has the worst posture on planet. He's like hunched over like Quasimodo. And I feel sorry for anyone that takes him adventuring, although he's very nice and he loves ladders. But it's people aren't gonna. A lot of people aren't gonna come away from Dragon's Dogma 2 with like their favorite named NPCs, their favorite quest lines, or that moment or reveal or twist along the course of the main quest. Like, it's just not that game at all. It's almost. Then I guess that's what I mean when I say it's like the antithesis of Starfield. Whereas Starfield was like you bounced around through menus, Dragon's Dogma is almost the opposite of that, which is like you were supposed to spend some time in menus. Like, you're going to collect new equipment, you are going to improve your gear along the way, you are going to do some crafting to try and make sure your bag's not getting too fucking full, because you will learn very quickly. You can't pick up everything you see in this game, otherwise you will be fucking slow running your way around that map. But I can't even remember the point I was making again, but like,
to Starfield, I think you it was the point you were making.
Yeah, the fact that you could argue that some of the things that make it different to Starfield are shortcomings. They don't feel like shortcomings because it doesn't feel like that was the kind of RPG they wanted to make. It doesn't feel like that was the kind of game they wanted to make. Honestly, from what I understand, it feels like the game they wanted to make was Dragon's Dogma. It feels like the vibe within the development team was actually we made the right game first time around. We just made it a little bit too early. So let's kind of just make it again and make it bigger and better and maybe a little bit easier to onboard certain players or get a little bit more mass market appeal, but not much. It kind of worked.
Let's carry on that thread, because the next story we were going to talk about was Dragon's Dogma 2, a couple of other elements. I was going to touch on something else, but I shan't, because I want to carry on this Dragon's Dogma. We'll loop back around. But I won't do that. I want to carry on talking about Dragon's Dogma, because you're actually touching on some of the development side of the game there, and I think it's a good jumping off point. As you know from the title of the podcast and the thumbnail, we wanted to touch on some of the, I'm going to go controversies, because they weren't controversies. But as Jamie's been saying, he's been playing some Dragon's Dogma 2 recently released. It did have somewhat of a rocky start, potentially, if you believe some of the reviews and things. It did get a bit of a review bombing early days. And it also had some issues with, I suppose, just like the headlines that I was seeing, a number of headlines on X that people were sharing, which was about like the problem with microtransactions. And you've already touched on a few things, like the scarcity of fast travel components and a couple of the other things that were sort of people were getting their backs up about, because the idea was that they were trying to squeeze every penny out of their audience, and this was already a full price game, and that the fact that they're charging you for things that should have been in game, having played it, and now that we're sort of a week down the line from this sort of that's quieting down a little bit, this sort of microtransaction controversy, where do you fall on that?
Yeah, I think it kind of answers itself in the sense that there's a reason a lot of the chatter around microtransactions has quietened down. I'd be curious to know what the kind of the updated Steam page looked like for Dragon's Dogma 2, because one of the numbers we pulled out here was that at one point at least 62% of the game's 4,700 reviews were negative. That when I saw that stat, I was like, that's way more than I thought. But I think it was almost a bit of a shock. Like, and I actually went onto the Discord that morning, because we have some hardcore Dragon's Dogma 2 fans on the Discord, and I kind of wanted to pick their brains, because I know what it was like for you, but I had an experience on X where I kind of fell asleep thinking, oh, Dragon's Dogma 2 critically acclaimed, you know, 87 on Metacritic, whatever it was. Everyone's looking forward to it. Woke up in the morning and it was the internet's like whipping boy. You know, everyone was going crazy. And there were these screenshots that, again, at first blush, having not played the game, looked really bad, where you're like, these, you know, no one in the press or anyone who was reviewing this game had any idea these microtransactions were going to be added. They've now been dropped for people who are buying this single player game at full price, which is in itself kind of an awkward look. And then again, with no knowledge of the game, you look at what the microtransactions are for, like you said, and you think see things like fast traveling, character customization, and you're like, oh my God.
Which I mean, that to me, on the face of it, having not played Dragon's Dogma 2 or 1 and having experience, like we're saying, of, you know, different sorts of RPGs, action RPGs, the idea that you're paying for fast travel, character editing, that sounds like a horrendous money grab from players you've already spent full whack.
It doesn't look great. And I think the fact that it doesn't look great was a lot of what contributed to the kind of the flaw in the early stages. As for whether or not it is actually a big deal, I think there are two ways of looking at it. My initial gut reaction is to say it's not that much of a big deal. And if you play this game, play the game for yourself, like, you will see why. A lot of these features, would-be features, like fast travel or character editing, are tied to items in-game. Right. So what you are doing is you are paying $1.49 to gain access to an item that exists within the world of Dragon's Dogma 2. So, like, yes, whilst fast traveling, like, the kind of the resources or the consumables you might use for fast traveling are rare, they exist, you can find them, you will find them. Same with like rift crystals. They're the currency that you can get to bring in pawns that are a higher level than you if you want their assistance.
Right.
Yes, you can go out and buy 1,500 rift crystals, but like most players will end up with many thousands of rift crystals however many hours of play on their own. So a lot of these are just convenience things. People who like letting people spend money if they want to take shortcuts or if they maybe make a mistake and like make the wrong decision and like, oh, I can't be bothered to go through all this work to do this thing in the game, so I'm going to do it. In the same way, lots of people were talking about Helldivers and saying super credits are in the map, like super credits are in the game. You can still buy super credits though. So there's a bit of that, which is why I think mostly it died down. The other argument, and I wonder what you kind of think about this, because it doesn't just apply to Dragon's Dogma 2, it applies to a lot of games that take that kind of defense of like, don't want it, don't buy it. I've heard some people make the argument that essentially, if you don't want it, don't buy it, or if you don't want it, just ignore it argument is null and void because it's impossible for these things to simultaneously be for sale and have been identified by a games developer or a games publisher as something that they can profit from and have a reasonable balance of their attainability within the game's world. Like, but at the end of the day, if Capcom decided to sell these things, it's because they felt like they could make money from them. And if they felt like they could make money from them, it's because they knew that at least some people would feel like it was more desirable to buy it than earn it or find it or easier or whatever it was. So at the end of the day, they're still kind of taking advantage of like someone in a way that perhaps they shouldn't be doing. I didn't really word it in the same way that I've seen some people word it on social media.
That's
the idea.
Yeah, I get exactly what you mean. Yeah.
If you don't like it, ignore it. Argument is stupid.
No, I completely understand what that argument is about because so we've all played, as our previous conversation, we've all played like those crappy mobile games which effectively give you access to whatever it is in the early game, and you play, and then you suddenly get to a point where effectively the game grinds to a halt unless you sink some actual money into it. Now there are then games like Helldivers 2 where they actively whilst they do have buyable currencies, they actively make it a part of the game that you do not need to spend any money to have a great time in this and get access to stuff, etc. There is therefore a line between money-grabbing mobile game, which is going to force you to spend money because the games are unplayable post that point, and a game that is effectively going, have the amazing time if you want, you don't need to spend any money in this, but you know you can. There's going to be a line where there's like a psychological flip where the number of people they capture wanting to spend money is going to be 100 people versus 10,000 people versus 100,000 people. And I think that is something that is probably the point is that Capcom was slightly on the wrong side of that line, and that people were feeling like things that should have been inherent in their gameplay that felt a little more scarce and were buyable. So I can, yeah. I'm gonna be a massive fence sitter and say that maybe part of it is people not appreciating some of the aspects that Capcom were trying to put into this game, like the fact they don't want you fast traveling, but the fact that you can buy fast travel packs for real money is not supposed to be like, well, that you go over here and buy them and we'll get your money and then you can fast travel. The whole point is they don't want you doing it. But then it's like, but hey, if you really want to do it and you're that sort of person who's not going to play the game unless you can, fine, spend some money and you can do it. But it sounds like they were on the wrong side of that to some degree and maybe should have tweaked the formula, moved the sliders a bit, made some of those elements a little bit more attainable in game so people didn't feel like they were missing out.
I think that's the thing. Like, I think that argument makes sense with something like fast travel. It's a slightly charitable argument, but I do kind of get it. I think it's less sense when it comes to something like character customization or allowing people to change what their characters look like. That's not something that impacts gameplay. It's not a system at all. It's a purely aesthetic thing.
And so that's skins, right? We do that in every other game we play. We pay real money for skins and stuff. So
I don't know if it is a skin. I think in a game where you create a custom character at the very beginning to ask you to have to pay money just to alter that character, and then you get into
Is it like you didn't like your hairstyle that you made originally, so now to change your hairstyle?
I think hairstyles can be changed, but like I've been to a place where there's a barber. I just haven't gone in there. So I don't really know the full extent of it, but all I was going to say is that like the piggyback to the argument that I was kind of making on behalf of some other people before about the reason don't like it, ignore it isn't like a valuable argument is because like we're never going to see behind closed doors and know the extent to which someone came over and whispered in a lead designer's ear and said, hey, tone down the scarcity of the item that lets you do X, Y, or Z because we're going to sell it. And it's a horrible argument to get into because no one knows. Was the vision exact and as pure as it was drawn up in the original blueprint and they just happened to add a microtransaction on top of that? Or did the microtransaction get drawn up and the scarcity of certain items, for example, in the world get toned down? We just don't know. But it becomes a slippery slope that, unfortunately, the way of never getting yourself on that slope is don't add microtransactions to your full-price single-player game.
I just don't
sell shit.
See, I don't mind them selling stuff. And so what, as a comment actually from Rodrigo in chat saying that it's a single player game though, so like I don't see a problem with it because if you want to spend the money, spend the money. Like if you don't. And I get that argument, but I also get your argument, which is it's a single player game. Don't put it in there. But at the same time, I can see an argument to say. So I suppose the analog would be like in a FromSoft game, if you could buy something that made a boss slightly easier, for example. And I'm sure there would be loads of people that would be really annoyed that there were people out there who were making their game slightly easier by spending real money. However, it's a single player game. What do you care? You don't have to make the game easier. You can have it as hard as the game was intended to be at the beginning. For me, it all boils down to, as you've just said, was there a whisper in the lead developer's ear to say, tone down the availability of that resource? Like, for example, if the analogy for FromSoft would be them going, tone up the difficulty of that boss so that they feel more compelled to buy the thing to make it easier. And just because you saw someone who was an insanely high level player defeat a boss, you think, I could do that. Like, reality, you can't. That if we got to that level of sort of like filth, then, but as you've said, it's almost impossible to know because you would need to know the numbers of people that have bought this stuff in game and how it compares to other games and all of that to know if it was fair. Like, I really don't know.
And it just muddies the waters a little bit. And like, don't get me wrong, I'm sure at the end of the day, the decision to make fast travel a thing that the majority of players will interact with very, very, very few times on their Dragon's Dogma 2 journeys, I'm sure that was entirely intentional. And from what I understand, there are interviews with the game's director that go back some time talking about how he doesn't like fast travel. But I don't like that it even leaves the window slightly open. The reason fast travel is as obscure and unseen in Dragon's Dogma 2 is because they can potentially financially bet. Like, and I don't think that's the case, but I don't like that window is, or that door is even ajar. That's why my net takeaway is just like, you made such a bold game. You made a game that, like, it is willing to be unlike a lot of its peers, and willing to piss a lot of people off, and willing to have like a difficult onboarding process. You've gone out there and you've made a game that some people are going to pick up, play 5 hours of, and go, "What the fuck was that?" Like, stick to your guns. You've made it. You've crossed the finish line. Like, you've done the hard part.
I could see an argument that it almost makes me think a little bit. You know, when you used to go to the supermarket as a kid, I think it's now illegal, and they used to put all the sweets right next to the till, so that when your mum was paying, you'd go, "Mom, can I have this? Mom, can I have a Mars bar? Mom, can I have a Twirl?" And then she'd be like, "Oh, for God's sake, yeah, all right." I almost feel like there's just having them in the game, having them available for, you know, an affordable amount, and you don't have to spend it, you can just get in game. Maybe there's an element of that, of like, is it too hard for some people to resist? But it's really tricky.
It's definitely too hard for some people to resist, or they wouldn't be there. Like, Capcom wouldn't risk the negative backlash unless it was financial. There will be like a graph somewhere with public perception of our microtransaction implementation on one line and people spending money on another. And at some point, like, those two lines were the right way around, and they were like, "Yeah, this is financially beneficial. It doesn't matter that the game will have 62% negative reviews on launch day on the biggest platform on the biggest storefront on one of our key platforms. Like, we'll happily take that hit, because, and admittedly, those negative reviews were about more than just microtransactions. PC performance was also a component of those reviews. So I don't wish to misrepresent what those reviews were about. But clearly they know that those people will not be able to stop themselves picking up the Twix at the counter, because that's why they're there.
I'm just gonna answer a question from chat. Just say it. So yeah, is it illegal in the UK to do that? Yeah, not everywhere, but they changed the law so that you can't have it as egregious as it used to be, specifically to stop kids begging parents for stuff.
They still do it, but it, nowadays, like, a lot of things, like, you see a lot of the health bars and stuff like that, like protein bars.
I think it's I think it's like sugar. Maybe it's down to like sugar content or something, because you never see chocolate bars next to the counter. It's always like chewing gum and health bars. You're right, and stuff like that. It's not like some fizzy drinks. Yeah, and things.
Jonesy's right. You used to stand in the queue for the till and be lined by these waist height like things that were just like, "Here's every chocolate bar on the planet that you're going to stand next to for an uncomfortable period of time as you wait to pay."
I don't want to derail where we're at with Dragon's Dogma, because we've got more to talk about, but one of the most egregious games that I see it in all the time, and I have to deal with it, is exactly that kid trying to buy the chocolate bar at the till thing, is Roblox. Is absolutely awful for in-game spend Robux to get this thing, which is completely useless in the grand scheme of things. And my kids are forever going, "Oh, can I have some Robux so I can buy this thing in game?" And I'm like, "What do you want to buy?" And they're like, they're playing the other day, something with Goku in it, and you could get a different Kamehameha. And they were like, "I want the demon Kamehameha, so then I don't have to click the button 10,000 times to get the demon one. I can just get it." And I'm like, "But you're just not going to play this in 3 minutes. You're going to be playing a different game and you're not going to care. And then you're just going to have wasted that money." And they're like, "But I really want it. And my kids are young. My kids are 5 and 7. So they are completely, they have zero gratification delay of their own, in their own right. Like, they will have anything they want. If you give it to them, they'll take it. They're not going to be like, "No, I shouldn't." They're like, I want it now. And yeah, Roblox is awful for, I know a kid who's 10, Ukrainian refugee kid, who made £150 through selling rare Pokemon cards that he'd got, like, randomly through packs, through people bought him at Christmas. And he spent all £150 on Roblox as Robux in-game purchases to, like, speed up the rate he could do this, get a different costume, do that. And I was like, "Dude, you spent £150 of real money on the crappiest games I've ever seen."
And again, to clarify, like, because of the way that Roblox works, and I think you kind of alluded to it there with the example with your kids, you're not even spending money on, like, on the kind of the overall ecosystem, or like a Like, no, you're sometimes getting money in individual games that you might never go back to.
I'll put it in old man language that we and some of our audience will understand. You remember so Roblox is, imagine going onto the Flash game sites that we used to go to, and you click on a really rubbish Flash game.
Yeah.
Imagine in that Flash game, you could spend a universal currency that covered the entire Flash site. So in every game, the person who made that game could put their own ability to spend Flash bucks. That's what Robux are. And in the game, it will give you some really rubbish, pointless, or totally OP game, like pay to win thing. But it's real money that you're spending, and they will just go through it. Like,
right. And so they'll sit there, they'll spend real money on the demon Kamehameha, and 5 minutes later they'll be playing a racing game, which is just
to do with what they're
doing. That's scary.
Don't get me wrong, I don't know if that's the whole platform. I don't know if there probably are games that you pay for decent stuff and there are decent games on there, but my experience with my kids playing utter crap, that they'll play utter shite for hours.
Like, because at least in something like Fortnite has a lot of other modes to it now, and like there are people playing Battle Royale still, there are people playing Fortnite Festival, and there are all these user created modes. But at least I can still take my John Cena skin into any one of them. Like, yes. I bought my John Cena, it's my John Cena skin.
Yeah. So you obviously, if you buy something in a game, you as far as I know, certain things like skins and stuff, you keep it if you play that game again. But these games are terrible. Like, they're fine. I mean, I shouldn't say they're terrible. If kids play them and enjoy them, that's fine. But they are. It's not like Fortnite where you can take that skin into another match. You might go and play the same map of an escape game again, and you might play it for 10 minutes, and you might look like a sausage, which is fine. But you then have to go and play. There's 50 other games that are almost identical that you then go and need to dress like a sausage in and spend real money to be a sausage. So it's bizarre, mate. It's utterly bizarre.
When you play Roblox with friends, do they join you as you and seamlessly come with you as you go in and out of games, or do you meet friends inside the games?
You meet them in the games, yeah.
Oh my god, I don't like the sound of any of this. If this is our future, I'm not a part of it.
Well, it's kind of like you log on, you have a list of all your friends at the top, and you can see what they're playing, and you can just join them in. That server, if you want to play that game, mate. I'll show you some of the games my kids play. You'd be like, you'd say, what is this? I have played them, which is shocking, because especially my 5-year old, he'd be like, Dad, I can't do this bit. Can you help me do this? And I'll just be like, what is this? It's laughable often. Anyway, we do have another slight controversy to talk about Dragon's Dogma. I apologize for derailing the conversation with Robux and Roblox talk. Please don't leave us for that, for what I've done there. Because we do need to talk about the thing that we put front and center, which is Dragon's Plague. Because after all of this died down, after people seemed to chill a little bit with the whole microtransaction debacle, or not debacle, whatever it was at the beginning, and Capcom sort of explained the situation and people sort of chilled a bit, we then had the realization for some players that there was something called Dragon's Plague, which your pawns could get. They could become infected, and over a period of time, as they got sicker and sicker, you could actually end up with a situation where if you made the wrong choice and let your little pawn fall asleep in an inn in a town when he was most most at his, like, when he was turning, when he peaked Dragon's Plague thing.
Yeah,
they could actually transform into a winged dragony beast and actually completely wipe out the populace of that town, including not just random NPCs, but we're also talking about quest givers, NPCs that are vital to your progress through the game. And and there was actually a number of players that thought effectively their game had been completely bricked because they couldn't then carry on. They couldn't carry on in some quest patterns, and they were not happy, to say the least.
Yeah. I don't know what you just say. I can't tell if I love it or hate it. Because on the one hand, I'm kind of scared that something like this might happen to me and it's going to be a bit of a pain in the ass to kind of unravel. But on the other hand, like, again, like so much of the conversation we've had about Dragon's Dogma 2 so far, what a fucking bizarre and wonderful design choice to just say, yeah, we'll put something like, this will be the consequence for this. It sounds like the kind of idea that, like, other more cowardly game developers would have had not done, and then talked about in an interview years later.
Wasn't there a thing in Elder Scrolls where they did that? No, World of Warcraft, where they had the plague. Oh, what was it?
You are asking the wrong guy, I'm afraid.
We talked about it years ago. There was like a weird plague thing, the blood plague or something like that, that was happening at one point. But I don't think it was quite as...
The corrupted blood incident. When participating in a boss battle at the end of a raid, player characters would become infected with a debuff that was transmitted between characters, like an STD. That was my words, not Wikipedia's, in close proximity. While developers intended to keep the effects of the debuff in the boss's game region, a programming oversight soon led to an in-game pandemic.
So it wasn't on purpose? Oh, okay, I take it back.
They had an accidental Azeroth pandemic.
That was it. Which was, yeah, it's, when I first heard about this, I immediately thought of that. I was like, is it a blood plague kind of situation? But no, it's apparently not as bad as that. It's not going to sort of like break everything because of a programming oversight. Because it was actually discovered that if you wait a period of, I believe it was a week, did you say? We were checking.
Yeah, I think some people were saying that if you pass time for about 7 in-game days, yeah.
Your NPCs, your quest givers do respawn, and actually things can continue and your game isn't perpetually broken. But I'm with you. I love this. I love developers who put in stuff that are like, they're obviously people that just love gaming and they love putting in crazy shit. The only thing that would make this better is if the pawns who are infected, because you were telling me some of the crazy stuff that they get up to, like they become more belligerent, they don't do what you say all the time. But if they became more powerful.
Oh, they're like a risk reward.
Yes. So you get to the point where you're like, oh, I really don't want to get rid of them. They're so powerful. And if the night is darkest just before the dawn, if the pawn is strongest just before they transform, that would be a great little, sort of thing to try and balance. Like, I've got this really tough enemy, this tough boss. I need a dragon's plagued up pawn, but the risk reward, and then it's going to wipe out a whole town, village, whatever, that, you know, if you get the timings wrong.
I think that would be really interesting. They'd probably need to take things a little bit further, because I think one thing I've gathered from all of this, for example, is that if you just never sleep or never rest at an inn or like in a town, then like this worst case scenario can never actually happen to you.
Right.
You would still have a pawn that has dragon's play. But yeah, the idea that like pawns are sort of disposable, and that if you notice your pawn like coming down with dragon's plague, because even the pawn that you create can get drawn into other people's worlds and go adventuring with them, and they might catch dragon's plague from other pawn along the way. And so if you notice it, you just have to kill them, like throw them into a body of water, because all the water in the game has this weird thing that like fucking eats them, and all this blood comes out. It's weird. I forget what it's called. But even that idea, like, it's great. And again, it's just another testament to kind of like how unique the vision behind Dragon's Dogma 2 was, but almost how much they committed to it in a kind of delightful, although it would still be incredibly scary. Like, that's why this almost sounded like a hoax, because it sounded like the kind of thing that someone would make up as a piece of scaremongering, like, oh, be careful resting in any towns, or you might find yourself waking up to find that all the NPCs have been killed. And then again, you go back to choices. Like, this is also a game with a very restrictive autosave system, where you also can only have one save per profile. So you can't roll back to a lot that, you know, the last save you made. The last save you made was when this happened. And if you can't be able to deal with the consequences, you have to start a new game.
I must admit, I thought it was I thought someone was having me on when I saw, because I just saw literally it was an X video where someone just walked through into their town and there were dead people was it empty, and they were like, oh no, I can't believe it, Dragon's Plague has wiped out this town, and I thought someone had just like slaughtered a town and then they were trying to, you know, get some clicks on X. I didn't even look any more into it, because I thought it was just someone making up. And literally until we sat down today and you pointed out the fact that no, this is a real thing that's been happening and is supposed to be in the game, which I was like, oh, that is actually pretty cool. The fact that there is some element of peril, because you have to, you know, you then got to skip time for a week or whatever. But it's not, it doesn't ruin your game. It doesn't completely break it. And also it doesn't then do the thing like the Bethesda thing of, oh no, you just can't kill certain NPCs because they're important for the quest. But you're like, Yeah, but I want to sometimes kill them. Even if they do come back, it's just fun for them to be dead for a bit.
Yeah, and like, I don't know, to have to... I don't know. I don't know what the plan was, whether like it's to like increase the rate at which people are paying attention to their pawns, or to the like you said, the added peril. But like, even if their plan was just to scare people inside the first week before the news about Dragon's Plague had really like spread, so that the first however many people this happened to were like, what the fuck has happened to my game? Like, I even kind of, I feel sorry for those people, but yeah. I respect it.
Yeah, I can be I'll be a tiny bit cynical and say, I do wonder going forward how much we'll see more stuff like this, because it does well on socials. And then it's a little boost to people talking about the game. Oh, have you seen this happen?
I've just remembered something. And I don't know what triggered this memory. Do you remember when Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice came out? And there was that thing that every time Senua died in the game, this like rot would increasingly like encroach up her arm, and like if it got to the top, then you would die. There would be a permadeath. You would die permanently and have to start a new game.
I don't remember.
And that was like what? I'll have to look it up, but I want to say that I'm kind of making this up as I go because it's coming back to me in drips and drabs. But I want to say there was a mechanic in Hellblade where, yeah, every time Senua died, there was, I think it was some kind of, like, rot or illness that was visible, like, on her arm or something like that.
Yeah.
And the game told you about it, and the implication was, if you die enough times, then there would be permadeath, and you have to start again. And it was kind of a scaremongering thing, because people did the homework and found out that actually, it wasn't real. It was the game trying to scare you, and you could die as many times as you like, and this thing never happened. Right. And some people had different reactions to it. Some people thought it was a clever way to increase sort of anxiety and paranoia in a game that was already about a lot of those things, and about how they affected Senua's mental health. And other people thought it was a gimmick that scared people unnecessarily, and so on and so forth. But I guess that was an example of a developer kind of having an idea about, what if there was this really disruptive, annoying mechanic, but not following through with it. But they still wanted to get the scare out. They still wanted to scare people.
And then being too worried that might, people could complain, put people off, wouldn't buy it. Because I often think like they need to be more games with permadeath. Like automatically delete your save or something to be like, no, you're dead. You've got to start from the very beginning.
I found it was so in the game, it was called The Dark Rot. Right. After witnessing a vision of her body being consumed by it, Senua's right arm is infested with the rot until the end of the game. The game warns players that if the dark rot will continue to grow on Senua's arm each time she is killed or fails. If the rot manages to spread all the way up to her head, then the quest ends and all progress is lost. There has been some debate as to what the warning of the rot's effects mean. Testing of repeated deaths by players in combat and environmentally have failed to trigger the permadeath state that the warning seems to allude to, even after 50 deaths. Right. I remember watching a YouTube video about it at the time.
No, I don't remember that. I don't remember. I kind of remember it, but I don't remember it as being linked to permadeath. But no, that's cool. That's cool that they toyed around with it, even for like either from the anxiety point of view. Let's move on to our final story, because what we do want to talk about for the last thing today is we're going to talk about GTA 6 and the fact that Rockstar have, we talked before about the fact that they've asked staff to come back into the office to work permanently from the office again, not work from home. You know, we talked about why that might be. Obviously, they've had issues with security, with leaks, but we've got a little bit of an update, I suppose, in that same thread, on that same line. Because as sort of some people who work there, the remote workers have sort of struggled to get back into the idea of working in the office again, having to go into the office. We've now had sources who have talked about the development process of the game and saying that it is looking likely that GTA 6 possible that GTA 6 could miss its 2025 release window and could actually slip into 2026. Which is the least surprising thing ever, I suppose. We've talked about this before and said that it was unlikely, or maybe it wasn't likely that it would actually be ready for 2025.
Right. Yeah, like a lot of the confusion around this and Kotaku haven't helped, because they appear to have kind of run both versions of this story. It seems to be about like what were Rockstar targeting internally? because there were also some reports before this 2026 thing came about that Rockstar were targeting early 2025. I don't know if you saw any of that, because some people started immediately getting quite excited, like, oh my God, what if GTA 6 is out in a year or so?
Yeah.
And I think it probably comes down to knowing, and the reality is none of us do, what that internal target was. If it was early 2025, then I think there's still a good amount of runway for them to, you know, miss some targets and some milestones internally, and to maybe get pushed back towards the end of 2025. If the internal release date was at the end of 2025, and that's what they meant when they put the 2025 date in that reveal trailer, then a delay to 2026 would be the least surprising thing on planet Earth. Not just because delays are sort of almost an inevitability of modern game development in some respects. Of course, it varies from studio to studio and from case to case, I get that. But Rockstar are the kings of delaying shit. Rockstar never release anything when they're supposed to, not least of all, you know, their big, you know, flagship AAA games. And again, you and I were working together through the process of, you know, anticipating Red Dead Redemption 2 from announcement to trailer after trailer and various release dates. Like, that was an agonizing process. And they did the exact same thing at the time. They gave themselves an entire year between reveal and release. And I can't remember how much extra time they bought themselves in the end, whereas I think it was like an additional 18 months. Like, they have been way off on their targets in the past. And maybe, I don't know, maybe some part of them wanted to kind of amend that ever so slightly, and maybe that's why they took so long to release GTA 6, but I'll believe that when I see it, to announce GTA 6, I should say. But I don't believe that for a sec. Like, I have no internal estimate as to when GTA 6 will come out. Nothing would help me.
Isn't it kind of like a moot point, really? Like, I don't think anyone, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think anyone will be there, you know, getting really frustrated that GTA 6 doesn't come out in fall of 2025 and it gets pushed to 2026, if it does, and saying, like, oh, I wish they'd just release it now. I think everyone's going to be on the same page of being like, no, we want the best version of GTA 6 possible. And if that's going to take an extra 6 months, it takes an extra 9 months. That's probably what should happen with most games. Even the ones that do get pushed, like, we'd rather they came out best foot forward, working perfectly, or as close to perfectly as you'd hope for, rather than the idea of, no, pick a random date, multiple years at this point down the line, you know, just have a guess 4 years down the line. Yeah, that seems about right. And then miss it and be like, well, surprise, surprise. You're making a massive game, hundreds of, if not thousands of people, millions of pounds, like.
But that's the part that people get annoyed about, no? Like, I think, you know, you can go,
I think people less so this day and age. I think people have becoming more and more realistic with it.
I think people are becoming realistic, and definitely you can go under the replies to any, you know, Twitter post about a delay and see, like, someone's going to pull that Miyamoto quote out their ass, and like, you know, everyone will broadly be of the same feeling that, like, yeah, of course, like take your time, make the best version of this game, make the best version of GTA 6 that you can. But the practice that people are annoyed about is just, like, stop announcing release dates before you know when the game's going to come out.
Yeah.
If you announce the release date at the end of 2023 for what we presume could be, let's say, the end of 2025, and you missed it. Like, so 2 years ago, you said, well, hopefully, like, just don't guess. And, like, we've seen some phenomenally successful games announce themselves with a turnaround time of 6 months, maybe a year. People would accept a year. But the further away you are, the more you're guessing. And the more of a guess it is, the more of a right people feel like they have to say, hey, you probably shouldn't have gotten the hopes up. That wasn't fair. And it's six of one, half a dozen of another. But I do kind of get the people who say that. Like,
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Release the trailers, put out the marketing materials, put out character stuff, you know, do all of that, but just don't put a year on it.
Yes. The difficulty, and you and I know this as editors who work to deadlines, the difficulty is sometimes you're asked, like, you know, it's not a question of whether you want to tell people, sometimes you're asked when something is going to come out, and you might get, and if you know, like, depending on the environment and depending on who you work for and how lenient they are, let's say if you don't know something's going to be done on a Thursday or a Friday, Sometimes you're in a situation where you have to say Thursday and hope for the fucking best. Sometimes you're in a situation where you say Friday and you kind of get away with it. And like, I guess we don't know the circumstances under which Rockstar ultimately felt like they had to announce the game, release a trailer, put any date on it whatsoever. There may well have been pressure. Like, there might have been pressure from Take-Two, who said, like, hey, shareholders need to see, like, some kind of public response to this trailer and to the idea of GTA 6 as, like, because it increased their confidence in our future budgeting forecast, or the amount of money that we claim we're going to make in this time. So we need you to put a trailer out with this date on it, which also internally you are targeting. And that's the other thing, like, internal targets slip all the time. Again, you and I know what it's like as editors for internal targets to slip like in a second. Like, sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'll have that done by Monday. And I'm sat there on Wednesday going like, where the fuck did I pull Monday out of my ass from?
You definitely need a deadline. Like, 100% you need a deadline. Because if you don't, I mean, look at Star Citizen, look at Cloud Imperium Games. If you don't have, if you have a buttload of money and no deadline, it's going to go on forever. We know that's going to happen. So we know that you need a deadline. But I think that internal deadline, the shareholder deadline, that should be a thing that, even if it leaks, for example, who cares? You never said it. It never came from an official source. It doesn't matter if Kotaku said it. It doesn't matter if IGN have said it. It doesn't matter if the most trustworthy ex-leaker in the world said it. You never say it. You just be like, these are leaks. We've never said that.
Yeah.
Then at least internally you can say to your people, no, we are aiming for this date. And if anyone then comes out and says anything, you fire them. No, I'm joking. If anyone then gets asked and they let slip, you just be like, look, we haven't given you a date. I think maybe that's the way to go. Internal dates only, never external dates, never official external dates. Just put out the marketing stuff. People can then guess. As you drop a trailer that looks like a massive gameplay trailer with loads of footage and characters and bosses and da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah.
People can guess to their heart's content, oh, this is definitely coming out in a year.
Especially, it makes so much more sense to, like, take the kind of the hands-off approach when, like, you see the way that video game development often works, especially when you talk about video game development on a massive scale that involves lots of different people, lots of different moving pieces. Like, I have to, like, without being indiscreet, I have seen games that are not public knowledge yet that have had a... I have watched a launch trailer for a game that ends with, you know how you get like the standard version, the special edition, and the Blood and Thing edition. I watched a launch trailer for a game end with those, like, those different retail SKUs of the thing at the end, right, as a splash screen at the end of that. I watched that trailer about 6 months ago. That game still isn't even public knowledge, let alone does it have a release date.
My new, like, bugbear.
Weird shit happens.
I know. People are immediately going to be like, well, it makes sense. My biggest bugbear is when a release trailer comes out and then it says wishlist it now on Steam. I'm like, you have no idea. Because it's like, you have no idea when this game's coming out. It could be years away, but I'm going to go onto Steam and click the wishlist this game button to put it into a thing to tell me when you do add a date to. No, because that feels like it feels more tangible created a Steam page for it.
Yeah, but I think a lot of the time wishlisting isn't actually because they want you to get a little ping when the game comes out. It's because it's a helpful metric when it comes to getting Steam to surface the game to other people.
Hate it.
Like, it's like when a game's not technically available for pre-order yet, getting people to wishlist a game.
And I've seen that as well, yeah. The most wishlisted game.
Yeah, it's an important Steam metric.
No, I hate it.
So obviously Steam is a battleground, and if you die on Steam, then your game dies.
I genuinely hate it. It's no different to me than like saying pre-order our game today and it's an announcement trailer, the game hasn't been made, but you could pre-order and you're like, what? Like, this is so... And then they're like, oh, sorry, our game's been delayed by 5 years. You've got a pre-order, right? Like, this is crazy. Like, no, I don't know. I don't like a lot of that stuff. I'd rather they waited, left it. But yeah, anyway, so where we're at the moment, following these Kotaku articles and, you know, updates that they've had is... They're effectively saying that the target is firmly autumn 2025, fall 2025, as the Americans would say. And most people are confident of hitting that date, but there's still the possibility that it gets delayed. So that's where we're at. Yeah, at the moment. Right. We don't know.
Also, code for this means absolutely nothing. I might do this, but also I might not.
Yes. And I think it is interesting, though, because the way that they have sort of framed this is the fact that part of the reason they're getting people back into the office is because there could be slippage of GTA 6. But as we've said, Rockstar always delay stuff. So that's maybe also a little bit of a bullshit reason to make people to say, well, we do need people back in the office because we're a little bit delayed on our production. It's like, you're always done. You were delayed when you had people in the office 5 days a week. You're delayed when you had them in 1 day a week. When they're totally remote. Yeah.
Also, again, it comes back to another weird point. Do you know what can't be delayed?
What's that?
A game that never had a release date.
That's so true. You can't be delayed.
Externally speaking, of course, strictly speaking. But in the eyes of the public, who are the ones who are going to get pissed off when you have to put out that Twitter post that says, we're really sorry, but we're not going to come out on this date. We're going to come out an entire year later.
No.
Those people never had to be disappointed. All those cyberpunk posts, where the point where it became a meme of like basically writing an apology on a yellow background because they had to delete that game so many fucking times.
Still broken to shit as well when it came out.
Still broken to shit.
No, I was like, but you were a little off. The Twitter post doesn't say, sorry, I have to delay the game. The Twitter post has to say something like, we know that our fans are amazing, but we have to think about our staff and they've been working really hard and we need to give them some time. And that's why the game is delayed. Like, come on, man. It's almost like you're blaming your staff for being real people. Like, just admit it and be like, yeah, we fucked up on the timings. We gave you a date when we shouldn't.
We forced those real people to speculate about something they had no idea about, and now we're making them take the blame for doing something that they had no reasonable way of doing to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is our last news story for the day. Oh, shall I circle back around?
I was going to say, could you say, because I think you already know the one component of this that I want to know more about.
I thought it would
be. So just tell people.
My little catch up, we delayed, obviously, we're talking about Dragon's Dogma. All I was going to mention was the fact that I watched the new version of Roadhouse, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and, of course, the person that JB wanted to talk about, Conor McGregor. What is his name? What is his little nickname? Conor the...
No, just no, the Notorious.
The Notorious. The Notorious Conor McGregor. I'd never seen the original Roadhouse, which was to the shock of a lot of my friends that were horrified. So I have actually subsequently also watched the original. But no, I liked it. This new version of Roadhouse I thought was very good. I thought Jake Gyllenhaal was very good. Having watched it and then watched the original, I'm like, it's obviously better because it's newer. Maybe that's not obvious, but it was like a good film that I enjoyed. It wasn't good.
Okay.
I don't know. Not good. It was...
Yes, sir.
It's
a better film, but not a good film.
Because it wasn't like you wouldn't watch it and be like, oh, that was a really good film. But it was fun. I had fun watching it. I watched it with my wife. She enjoyed it as well. We kind of both said the same thing, which was that it's not going to get loads of awards and anything like that. But it was a cool action film, and it is a cool concept. And Jake Gyllenhaal was very good. Conor McGregor.
Yeah, here we go.
Like, not that bad, I suppose.
Okay. Yes. That's almost like the least entertaining thing you could have said.
It was kind of weird. Like, at one point, I think he was trying to do an American accent, but then they went back into Irish, and then people even comment in the film about the fact that he's Irish. So I was like, maybe his accent is just weird now because he's got that pan-American sort of thing because he's been in America a lot. One thing I cannot take with Conor McGregor, anyone who likes UFC, I'm sure will have seen this with him before. He has a very strange, like, walk where he tries to...
The Vince McMahon walk?
No, but it's worse than that. I think he tries to make himself look muscly.
The pose that he does in Suits where he kind of, like, gorilla arms himself.
But he doesn't just put the arms out. He does he brings his shoulders up.
Yeah, he makes his, like, traps as big as he possibly can and, like, and like puts his arms out. Yeah,
but then does a weird thing where it almost like brings his head down and brings his shoulders up.
You kind of roll your head back to try and make your neck look as wide as it can get. Yeah,
and then he spent like most of the film walking around naked like that. Or
naked?
Naked multiple times. At the very least, topless a lot. And he...
No wonder your wife enjoyed it.
And the character he played was fine, but it just seemed like in every scene he was in, he was walking from place to place with no shirt on, or naked, walking like that. And then was getting into fights, obviously.
Were the fights good? I heard they used some weird... I don't know if it's like a new thing in fight choreography, but there's this technique they used with like pillows where they would like do a slate where one person was like punching a pillow, and then they do a reverse slate where the other person was kind of being hit by a pillow, and they use visual effect. Excuse me, I just knocked my mic. They use visual effects to kind of combine the two together. So like you actually have someone hitting something and someone getting hit by something, but when you like superimpose the
I think
to try and have like to try and create a sense of like a contact that a lot of modern day action editing actually kind of shies away from, because it's the part they usually have to fake.
I thought the fighting was pretty good. Like I think you can note it. The one thing I sort of said was that you can, and this is why you hire them immediately. Obviously, you know that Conor McGregor is a legit fighter, and you can even see some of his stancing up and some of his positioning is how he fights in UFC. Like he had some of that ranging, that he's got a bit of a weird motion to him about him when he fights. He sort of swaps from foot to foot. When it comes to striking, obviously he's like an all-round striker. And he has that weird kind of almost like drunken boxer movement, doesn't he? Like he rocks from side to side, and he included some of that. It looked like he'd been maybe working with Jake Gyllenhaal a bit about how that they're for the choreography. So you had some real like visceral, very good fights. That much more impactful. That it is hilarious watching that one and then watching the original with Patrick Swayze and just seeing the difference in the, because that was a time when they were like karate is the ultimate fighting style, and it is laughable. Like it's laughable, like the sort of fighting that Patrick Swayze does. This was much more visceral, much more impactful, very cool. I had a friend of mine who's a big Roadhouse fan who said he didn't like the speed ramping in the fighting. Which is
okay.
I get that.
Yeah, sure.
That sort of thing can put a lot of people off. Just add a bit of dynamism to the fights. But no, I liked it. I think it's worth a watch if you've got Amazon Prime. Maybe check it out. You can also watch the original on Amazon Prime as well if you wanted to.
Bit of random trivia for you. I'm not sure if this had anything to do with Conor McGregor's ultimate casting in this version of it. But prior to this Jake Gyllenhaal led version of Roadhouse, a remade Roadhouse was intended to be a Ronda Rousey vehicle during the heights of her career.
So she is wooden as any film I've seen her. I think I've only seen her in one, actually, a Fast and the Furious film. I thought she was very wooden with the acting side.
She is. She's not great.
But the fighting, again, like fantastic fighting. I know there's Gina Carano was a bit like that. She was a better actress, but still she came into the acting. She got better and better.
Steven Soderbergh's film that was basically just like a 90-minute Gina Carano action film that had like was really like it was quite tight and well done, and had a bunch of other good
Michael
actors
Farr, Michael Fassbender's in it.
Yeah, I want to say Channing Tatum was in it as well.
Yes, that rings a bell. Is it Hardwired or something like that, or
Haywire?
I think it's Haywire. That's a good film. She's not. Yeah. Even in The Mandalorian, like I liked her in Mandalorian, I liked her in Deadpool. She is not the best actress,
right? Yeah,
but I
didn't mind it because it was almost like Steven Soderbergh said, like, "Hey, I'm making a 90-minute like hardboiled action film, and I want a leading lady who is better at fighting than acting."
She's so good at fighting. Like her route, as soon as they start fighting, they're amazing. Like they're so good at the fighting. The choreography is fantastic. I would say that Conor McGregor actually pulled his weight. I would more than. Ronda Rousey more than Gina Carano. Like I think he did a good bit. He was playing a character that fit him very well. It was this like manic Irish fighter, like a enforcer kind of guy. It played to his strengths. Maybe if he was trying to play a different role, a bit more nuanced, then he would have really struggled. But I liked it. I thought it was good. Yeah,
I think I will make the time to watch it, especially because it's an Amazon Prime joint as well, right?
Launched
day and date on Amazon Prime, so no reason not to. I also just want to say in passing, Haywire had no the cast for Haywire is insane. I know we said most of them, but
yeah.
Gina Carano, we said, but Michael Fassbender, Ewan McGregor, Bill Paxton, Channing Tatum, Maciej Kasowicz, Antonio Banderas, and Michael Douglas.
I don't remember that half of those people were in it. I've not seen it for a long time, but that film's worth a watch. If you like action films and you like female leads and you want to see a woman who can legit... We've all seen Charlize Theron jokingly punch a 300-pound man and the man goes flying and you're just like, this is ridiculous. Or watch Sylvester Stallone punch a 300-pound man and watch the man go flying and think this is ridiculous. But you legit want to see a fighter kick the crap out of some really famous actors.
Hey, you better not come on this. You better not come on the next episode of this podcast starting to tell people to watch Terror on the Prairie on Daily Wire Plus next week.
What's Terror on the Prairie?
That was the thing when the Daily Wire made their own film production company, and we were like, yeah, we're gonna make films that aren't woke, and we're gonna put Gina Carano in them. And that was the Western they
what
made.
Is Haywire woke? What is Haywire?
No. I'm joking because Gina Carano is still at present.
Oh, she persona non grata.
Okay. Well, yeah, but I mean, she got fired by Disney and hasn't worked in quote unquote Hollywood since.
Right.
So I thought I was joking that because you were promoting Gina Carano's body of work, that next week you'd be back here to tell people about the benefits of the Daily Wire's subscription service.
I ain't got time for politics when I'm watching actors. You try and look at the politics of actors and then decide whether you're going to watch their films or not. You're not going to ever watch anything ever again. Like, imagine the scumbags in Hollywood. Like, that.
Actually, Gina Carano was recently in a Lawrence Fox film. There you go.
Oh, the English dude who was being really... Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
he's a one, isn't he?
Billy Piper's
ex-husband. Jesus Christ.
Anyway, we're getting into the weeds now, sorry.
We are. I didn't even know he was an actor. I saw something, I heard something the other day where they talked about him and they said, actor Lawrence Fox. Like, is he an actor? But
I can't remember where he peaked, like what he was.
No idea.
He's best known for his role as James Hathaway in the TV drama Lewis from 2006 to 2015. Yeah, it was an ITV drama. That's what Wikipedia has to say. The film was called My Son Hunter, which is a biographical comedy film about Hunter Biden, with Lawrence Fox playing Hunter Biden and Gina Carano co-starring.
And this is a Daily Wire film they've made.
That was actually distributed by Breitbart News.
Who's the fella who used to work for Donald Trump? Andrew Breitbart, is that right? Or am I
Andrew Breitbart, yeah. Andrew Breitbart was the guy who created the Breitbart News Network, which is an American far-right news opinion and commentary website.
But I'm sure he was like a communications thing for Donald Trump. I can't. Anyway, this is getting weird. Head over to the Discord and you can go to the politics tab and you can tell me who Andrew Breitbart is because I do not know enough about this. Because this is a video games podcast. But with that, Jamie... we've come to the end. It's just time to say, if you do want to catch us, YouTube and Twitter, Super Show Pod, and obviously on the podcasting platforms. Thank you so much, Jamie, for joining me, for being awesome self with all your expert knowledge across the gaming sphere. It is always very well received and very welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for steering the ship. I appreciate it.
And thank you to all of the people who are watching and have been chatting along with us on YouTube. This will be on podcasting platforms from tomorrow, so if you can check it out there. But then I suppose you wouldn't hear this until you'd heard it on those platforms if you hadn't already seen it on YouTube. So that was kind of a redundant thing to say. So all that is left for me to say is that we will catch you next week, probably same time, same place. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.